So, I have this very strong sense that when a community comes together like this to practice, there is kind of a profound group mind, profound collective womb that comes together, that the way in which we influence each other or touch each other or learn from each other, the ways in which we are informed by each other, by all kinds of things. And we're kind of all in it together. So it's not just an individual growth and development in the Dharma. It's also a collective growth and development that those of us who are here at IRC have maybe a little bit more strongly together. People on the online retreat have among themselves. There's a bridge between the two communities. The biggest one, I think, is Diana, who's been a wonderful teacher for the online group. And she tells me a bit about what's going on, how you all are. And it's been nice to feel the connection for her talking about. And then also this little tablet that now has appeared on the Dharma platform, teaching platform. Amazing. So I can look down and I see many of you, yeah. Mary's waving. I don't see all of you at once, but I see about, I guess I see about 15 tiles at once. And so the collective, the communal, the group, evolution and change. And some of that can be pretty deleterious for people in certain environments they grew up in or live in. But some of it is quite inspiring and beautiful. And I like to think that when we do the Dharma, we're in it together. And we do learn from each other and change together in different ways. And my growth as a teacher over the years, it's very clear that I've grown in relationship to the communities that I teach in. There's a feedback loop that I'm affected by and changed by and learned by. And I'm also part of different teacher circles, Buddhist teachers, all kinds of different little circles I'm part of. And some are insight teachers, some are other schools, some are kind of mixed school Buddhist groups, teacher groups that I go to sometimes. And and I don't know if we know what the Dharma is really, but we're in a big conversation. And we might say we know what it is, but that's our contribution to the conversation. And that somehow we kind of influence each other and change and grow. And over these decades that I've been a Dharma teacher and been together with other Dharma teachers, there are definitely trends in how to teach the Dharma, trends in practice that you wouldn't know if you didn't watch it over a long period of time, because these Dharma teachers like me present it as if, like, this is it, or something like that. So the Buddha said, and therefore it's like that's what it is. But there's this bigger conversation, this bigger evolution. I like to think of it as a growth that we're all part of and sharing. And I think it's really marvelous to be part of it. And I think that what inspired me to say this at the beginning is that I felt finished yesterday teaching talks. They have coming and giving a talk today. Just didn't feel like that was going to happen in any kind of appropriate way. And it's, you know, and so now there is, you know, I got some questions on the board. Some of you put questions down. It's nice. Thank you. And, but that's coming from you. Right? So now it's kind of like, yeah, it's not just up to me. It's up to your questions too. What happens next? And what grows and develops here? And I appreciate that a lot. I think it's so, you know, it feels appropriate to me that it's now kind of a little bit thinking more that kind of coming from you also with your questions, and that influences what I say. And who knows what mysterious ways that this is evolving together, and why someone asks a question, why I answer what way I do, and what's it informed by, or how does it arise in the womb of a community? And then those are kind of what I was thinking about coming over here. So it's very nice to be part of it. This is why I love being on these retreats, where I feel we're all practitioners together. We're all here to be changed and to grow and become freer. So some of the questions that came. Oh, this is not a question, but can everyone hear me? Because some of the hearing system devices not working very well. So with people, it's okay? Okay. And I like this. I liked all the questions, but here. I do an hour sit in the evening. It's a sit with eyes closed until the timer goes off. Meditation. I mentioned I get pleasantly concentrated, but nothing crazy. I love it. Is it okay to continue in this way? Yeah, I loved hearing this little account, reading this little account. How I read it was, it's the sit with eyes closed until a timer goes off meditation. It sounded like it wasn't, it's the breathing meditation, it's metta meditation. It doesn't say it's a specific meditation practice. It's just sitting there and just to be. And I think it's really important, I think, to have some time in our life, in our days, where we're not doing anything, but allowing just things to arise and show themselves and disappear and see what wants to percolate. I like going for walks. When I used to go to the gym, I loved going to the gym and doing these exercise machines, because in both kind of circumstances, walking and exercise, I give my mind completely free rein to think whatever it wants to think, in a way that I don't really do. I don't do in meditation. So it allows me to see what's going on in my mind in a very different way, or in my life, very differently than I would see it in meditation. And I feel it's important for the mind and heart to kind of have this, a chance for this kind of just open, free place just to let things, thoughts and feelings and concerns, and I get to kind of find out what's going on in there in a different way. Sometimes I remember what I've forgotten. Uh-oh. So I don't know exactly what the person was doing in this wonderfully titled meditation, sit with eyes closed until timer goes off. But I just love the idea that kind of time, just nothing special. Maybe it would be good if there was another meditation practice, maybe that was a little bit more focused or a little bit more, you know, thematic or a little bit more focused, you know, but Seems great. Then there are two questions that were related. What is the best way of keeping experiences we have had on in insights or insights we have gained on retreat close to the heart moving forward? What is the balance between some kind of effort to do this and trusting that a deeper shift is taking place, even if we don't make the effort to remember? Can you discuss some of the specific ways to sustain and integrate our practice when we return back to the world? So, and for me, these two are related. And I love these kinds of questions because it means that there's been value in received through the practice here. And now the question is, how does it, what's valuable going to continue or live in me as I leave here? And this idea of keeping these insights close to the heart. That's a lovely thing, the way of saying it. Just close by, because maybe you don't have to do much with a lot of the insights, the understanding, what's happened here, but just keep it close to the heart or close to the profound place so it can keep working. And then maybe trusting that. But trusting, I think, one of the things we have to offer if we want deeper trust to operate in us, or this kind of deeper kind of the way we've been touched, we need to take time, give time for it. If we go back and rush into life again, then there's no space in the heart, no space within to let the things percolate and digest and work on us. So often at the end of a retreat, I encourage people to think that the retreat is only half over. So that however long the retreat in, it's really twice as long as it's been publicized. So this is actually a 4-week retreat. And so for the next 2 weeks, the retreat's still going to be working in you in seen and unseen ways. And so kind of give yourself a little more space to let it keep working on you or be here, or certainly give a lot of give yourself a lot of acceptance if somehow you feel a little bit unusual when you leave. It's some people, for example, when they leave, the longer the retreat they leave, the more hyper they are talking when they leave, and they won't stop talking. And so they have some compassion for your friends. And some people, the last thing they want to do is talk. It's just everything's overwhelming. Some people, their energy level goes really sky high. Some people, they crash and need to sleep a lot. And some people do both. And some people, none of this happens to. And some people can feel unexpectedly sad day after a retreat. Some people, as soon as they get home, and they snap at their loved ones in the way they never do before. Like, what happened? I just came 2 weeks of this retreat, you know. The people at home say, what? What's this Buddhism stuff? some of the inhibitions are lowered, and sometimes the sensitivity that we've been in, they're sometimes we're more easily triggered, or there's less, or the contrast between how we were and challenges we get are so high coming back that sometimes we're not quite ready and up to speed to be somehow wise about how to handle it. So, to be very forgiving and ask for forgiveness if you need to, but to be, to be accepting but to go slow if you can, and so that there can be both a gradual kind of acclimatization to the daily life, but also so some of the deeper things that happen here are still happening have a chance to kind of unfold and resolve themselves or be better understood or something. Who knows what's supposed to happen? So time. It could be going for a walk. It could be meditating. It could just, you know, sitting looking out the window and have tea. It doesn't take a lot to have a Sabbath day if you can manage that. Sometimes it's helpful to, if you have notes or we have these Dharma talks from the retreat, and sometimes it's nice to dip into them in the next week or two after a retreat to be reminded, to be touched in, oh yeah. And sometimes listening to the talks or following the instructions again, the guided meditations, it kind of picks up where you left behind or what we left off, or allows something to kind of reawaken or kind of come forth again in a way. Oh yes, that was right. And then, you know, it's there to kind of work on you or for you to work with it again for longer. And there are deeper shifts that go on that you can't see. The longer the retreat, the longer you should wait also before you decide how you've been changed by it. Whatever you think has happened to you now, today, or tomorrow, well, that's probably nice. But it might be very different in a month, or 3 months, or 6 months. And sometimes it's not only much, much later that we see what changes happen on the retreat that are enduring. And we wouldn't know it today. It might be surprising what happened here. I remember there was someone in my early years as teaching who I would have said at the end of the retreat, you know, so if I was that person, or if how was that person's retreat? I thought it was really hard and difficult, and maybe the person shouldn't have come. And 6 months later, the person said, that was so important for me for that retreat, because it was difficult, but I learned how to be with difficulty, and my life has been difficult since then, and that retreat really prepared me to be able to be wise and present and find my way through it in a way that I wouldn't have otherwise. So that was not, you know, come to the retreat to have difficulty. We don't advertise that. It'll benefit you. But, you know, the retreats can take so many different shapes. So not to jump to conclusions. The first week or the first 2 weeks, what the retreat's about, you know, that was a disaster. You don't know. Or that was like the best ever. You don't know. Wait and let it work on you. Wait and see, give it time. Make room. Give room for it to evolve and develop. I think that some of the, sometimes some of the most important things for the retreats, is not to inspire you to practice more, but that's one reason some people come and practice on retreat, because their home practice has waned, and so by coming on retreat they get this big boost, and now they can continue for a while. But sometimes it's not the meditation after the retreat that's important, but rather it's to explore the depth of what's important for you. Maybe what's important for you, what kind of intentions, motivations are important for you? What are the values you want to live by? And to spend time reflecting on that, contemplating that after a retreat can be very helpful, because we have a different eyes, different heart to look at these questions. You know, what's really important for me in my life? What's my heart's deepest intention? What are the relationships that are most important for me? And so start kind of asking kind of deep questions about yourself and what's important, and don't settle for one answer. I've done this a lot in my life, and sometimes I'll ask myself for sometimes months in a row, the same question, like, what's my deepest intention? And for a year, I asked the question every morning, if I'm going to die tonight, how would I live this day? And so there was always a different answer, there was different perspectives on what would happen to me when I asked these questions. So this art of asking questions about values and intentions, motivations, goals, what's most important for you, is another way that the retreat can continue or integrate after you go. Specific ways to sustain and integrate our practice when we return back to the world to sustain. I don't know if this is that, you know, best advice for everyone, but I do suggest that you know, I teach meditation, right? I've spent years doing it, so I probably think it's pretty important. But I think more important is this question, what is your deepest intention? What's the deepest thing that you intend for yourself or for this world? And if meditation doesn't connect to that, maybe you shouldn't meditate. Your deepest intention is important. You're important. And it'd be nice if meditation is connected to what's most important for you. But if it's just stress reduction, I guess that's good. Maybe kind of, it's like going to the gym. And so it just helps you keep in shape so that you can live a good life. So that's good. But I like the idea that it's really connected to your deepest intention. But then sustain, keep it going. I think it helps to practice in community. And so nowadays it's pretty easy to find a place to practice in community because you can practice with a Zoom community. You can find a sitting group all these sitting groups that during the pandemic ended up on, so many of them ended up on Zoom, and they now don't want to stop because people join them from all over the world. They can't stop without losing their community. So there's lots of them around now. And then if you live a place where there's people, three-dimensional people, we haven't become obsolete yet. I think it's still very valuable to be with people in person. And in terms of sustaining practice, we learn a lot as practitioners from other practitioners. In the monasteries I lived in, my sense was that most of the monastics actually learned more from their fellow monastics than they did from the abbot. The abbot would give teachings, would give inspiration, but then there were all this discussion about the Dharma talks and about the Dharma, the teachings, the practices, and so much happened between the students that was really helpful. And then also, we influence each other. Some of it, I think, it's called osmotic, maybe, that there's ways in which just being in a room full of meditators and how they sit, how they conduct themselves, how they breathe, how they speak, how they relate to each other, might be radically different than how people are, at the mall. And so there's something kind of goes into the system, something registers. We learn a possibility. We're maybe inspired. Part of the growth is learning in a good way from the community you're with. So practicing with people. And then Robert Aiken Roshi was one of the kind of elder Zen teachers in the United States. I practiced with him for a while. And people would come with this wonderful question. How do I integrate my practice into my life? It's a great question. I love it when people ask that. But he did this beautiful, wonderful thing. He turned the question around. How do I integrate my life into my practice? And at some point, that becomes the question that's more interesting. or it's possible that more important than life, whatever that is the practice. Practice is life. Practice is the home, you know. And so this practice is how I want to be in the world. And now that has the priority. The world is important, but the world now has to be integrated into the practice. And so it's a different way of looking at it. And it may be a way of letting the practice be more complete rather than piecemeal little practices you bring here and here and here into your life. What are the Pali words that the Buddha used that are now translated for us to understand as relax? I take this partly from the Anapanasati Sutta, the Discourse on Mindfulness of Breathing. And there is the verb is pasambati. And it means something like the dictionary doesn't have relax. That's my attempt to make it relevant for the modern world. But the English translations, many of them, they can at least speak of Bodhi, has tranquilize, or make tranquil. And that's okay. But since tranquilizing has rather unfortunate associations, that, it's a kind of little hold away from it. So relax is more physical. Also relax is more closely connected to our muscles, I feel. So it's kind of immediate, maybe. But it also means to calm, to ease, to subside, to something, to quiet something down. So exactly how it should be translated into English is the translator's choice. So I like to ease. I like the word ease a lot. I also liked using the word calm. Sometimes I did that sometimes on the retreat, to calm, to quiet. Surprised me when I came across this in the suttas that, I had grown up in Buddhism and Zen where you kind of weren't allowed to do anything in practice except just be present. And you weren't supposed to do anything to intentionally change yourself. You're supposed to show up and be present. That was kind of how I understood it. And then I read the suttas and it says you're allowed to relax. What? That's not natural, is it? And then there were two questions that I was more interested in, that they shared a word. Both of them shared the word reconcile, reconciled and reconcile. And I'm not sure what that word means, reconcile. And why things have to be reconciled. You mentioned that the Buddha expounded on teachings of gradual awakening. How do you reconcile this with your training and experience in Zen? For instance, our notions of sudden enlightenment, that is Dogen's practice realization, in Zen contradicted by gradual awakening. Please explain. But if this question is too Zen-centric for a Vipassana retreat, and you wish to decline, it is totally understood. That was generous. It's such a huge question. You know, we could have write a dissertation on this topic. I once asked Bhikkhu Anelio, he'd done some study or some contact with Dzogchen, a Tibetan form of meditation, and he knows a lot about mindfulness meditation, and I asked him, well, how do these compare, or are they similar in some ways or different? How are they different? And he just was uninterested in that question. He said, they're like apples and oranges. you don't compare, and they're so different. They're completely different from each other. They have their own, I didn't say this, but they have the whole, their own whole worldview, philosophy, that's the basis for each of these practices. And to not understand the foundation of being so, the worldviews are different, and then try to compare the practices, kind of, you know, maybe it's not that interesting. You just let each one be, I had a feeling like you just let each one be itself. And, you know, and be happy with that. No need to compare or contrast or something. Zen and Vipassana, the same thing. That, you know, they're different, almost like different worldviews that are in operation. And we tend to sometimes to think that Buddhism is one big happy family of things that are, we're all Buddhists and therefore we're all, you know, basically the same. But, you know, there's, it's, the differences are phenomenal between different schools of Buddhism, different eras of Buddhism, different teachers of Buddhism. And you, probably many of you know the diversity of just Christianities. You know, it's a, and it's possible there's greater diversity in Buddhism than there is in Christianity. So, maybe. So, you know, to make these, you know, to compare, contrast. But what I find interesting about the second part of the question is somehow connecting it or reconciling it or relating it to the teaching of a particular Zen teacher, the Dogen Zenji, who was the founder of Soto Zen, the school of Zen of San Francisco Zen Center, where I practiced. I don't know if he had the idea of instant enlightenment or sudden enlightenment exactly, but he had this, what mentions here in the question, practice realization. And this is a very profound idea, that a moment of practice is realization itself. So in that sense, it's instant. And so it seems like, well, then there's no gradual. It's just, you're either you're there or you're not. But it turns out that if people get a hang, little, start getting a little bit in the territory of what that's like, to practice realization, they kind of slowly over years grow into it fully. Very few people understand what it means when they first come. They do the best they can, and then slowly, slowly, they gradually come to understand why it's practice realization right now. And so there is gradual anyway, but they don't talk about it and so much. But I think that what Dogen is pointing to here, this practice realization, would be comparable to the how a Theravadan practitioner would practice after stream entry. After the first experience of awakening, then they have a reference point for practice that is a little bit what I talked about during the retreat. You know, that's separation, fading away or freedom, and cessation. And I kind of summarized them all three as being really rooted in non-grasping, non-clinging. And to have had a powerful enough experience of non-clinging, that non-clinging now becomes a reference point for how we practice now, then it becomes realizing or understanding or embodying the goal of the practice each moment that we practice. It grows, it develops, it's like a flower that develops or a plant that grows and becomes bigger and bigger. But the seed for that growth happens with the experience of non-clinging is strong enough. And then it becomes kind of similar to what Dogen's talking about, practice realization. So here's the other reconciliation question. And how can Dharma and the scientific inquiry be reconciled? Both methodologies leading to replicable experience. I don't know the answer. I'm not sure they need to be reconciled, do they? Can't they each be their own thing? But what I like about both that they share, I think, At least the way that I don't know about all of the Dharma, all of Buddhism, but some of the teachings from the early suttas is this idea of being very clear about what your assumptions are. Be very clear about where your ideas are coming from that you're basing your discussion, your beliefs, your opinions on. And so, you know, there's certain things that, you know, are not replicable. They're just the values you live by or beliefs you live by. And so so the idea would be you wouldn't say this is the truth. You would say, I believe in the value of nonviolence because that's what the Buddha emphasized. It's based on the Buddha's teaching, I value nonviolence. Based on my experience, I value nonviolence. Based on my logic, I worked it out logically that the world's a better place if we're nonviolent. So based on my logic, we're nonviolent. Based on my teacher, based on my school, my church, or my religion, or my whatever I'm part of. So we say this based on this, and that's not exactly science discovering what's replicable or discovering some new thing in nature. But I think this kind of honesty about what we're basing our teachings on or basing our religion on, our practice on, and being clear and knowing that, I think is really helpful. It's a lot easier to be in discussions then, because religion, I don't know if you notice this, but occasionally religious people are really excited about what is really ultimately true. And they really kind of, sometimes they're like really committed and excited about what's ultimately true. And sometimes they really want to tell you what's ultimately true. And sometimes they're ready to argue because they know what's ultimately true, and what you think is ultimately true is not really ultimately true. So in terms of replicable experience, it doesn't take a lot of research to see that people who argue about ultimate truth just cause a lot of suffering repeatedly. And in fact, one of the wonderful things about the earliest strata of the Buddhism, what's considered some of the oldest texts, or the oldest text that survives in Buddhism, the Buddha said, it was really explicit about, don't be concerned with ultimate reality. Now that's like a little upsetting, right? I mean, don't we want to have, you know, if our religion's going to count for something, it has to be based on what's ultimately true. And we want to, you know, then we can be confident and, you know, I don't know we're right. And, you know, it's good. And kind of, you know, religious people sometimes like to think, want to be right. And then they want to assert their rightness on you. So methodology. So I don't know, Dharma and scientific inquiry reconciled. I think just if everyone's honest, maybe that's enough to reconcile them. So those are the questions I got that arose out of this community. And I don't know what that represents for us as a whole and how that works to feed, nourish our eggs that are growing, developing, our collective eggs. But I put a lot of value in this process we are all in together, both individually and collectively. And I'm very grateful and appreciative for this, and appreciate all the questions you brought now, these written ones, but also during these 2 weeks, to these practice discussions. Thank you so much. So, a couple of things for the people online, and I'll be a little apologetic that, you know, I took these questions from the group here and, you know, and it didn't fold your questions into here, but I will be meeting with you tomorrow morning at 9:15. And then for the rest of the day, the schedule here changes, and for the people online also then, it changes this evening, and we'll come back into the hall at 7:15. At 7:30. So we have the sitting that ends at 7:15, and now there's a 15-minute period of break or walking, and then we start here at 7:30 rather than 7:45. So the person who rings a 7:45 bell to bring people to the hall, are you here? Yes. So you have to do it 15 minutes earlier than you usually do. And then that 7:30 period, we'll do a short sitting. I'll give a short kind of final talk on this topic of the retreat. And we have some other things we do, and maybe we'll do some more questions, and you can say it out loud. And then we will take, the managers have announcements about the closing and how the process unfolds over the next hours of the retreat. So, thank you all. Take good care of yourself.